Chapter 79. Everything was horrible. One of the last actions of the Versailles Treaty was to brand Germany guilty with a red-hot iron. Germany had to be exhibited to the world as so bestial a menace that no punishment would ever be enough to atone for its crimes. This was the only way to justify the Allied mutilation and pillage of Germany, which were unprecedented in European history. Only if Germany bore the entire guilt for the war, like the blot of original sin, only if it was Germany which had committed the worst atrocities, could the Allies justify their treatment of the monster. So reasoned the Avengers. British master propagandists had invented a long list of German atrocities, which had been used and recycled throughout the war, either to keep their unfortunate cannon fodder at a fever pitch of indignation or to outrage naive third parties into joining the war on their side. There is not a serious historian today who would dare attribute the sole guilt for World War I to Germany. The Kaiser, there is no doubt, enjoyed saber-rattling, and would have been better advised to watch developments in Austria at the beginning of 1914 instead of vacationing on his yacht Hohenzollern in faraway Norway for 3 whole weeks. However, British greed, French thirst for vengeance and Pan-Slavic intrigues and provocations were far more responsible for the war than all the blustering of Kaiser Bill. Poincaré, a bitter and mediocre little man, did everything in his power as President of France to precipitate the war. Even de Gaulle later admitted that the war fulfilled Poincaré's secret hope. Although the weight of historical evidence points the finger at the Allies, there is still ambivalence on the subject among the successors of the 1919 Allies. They are trapped in the lies that led to World War II, once more trapped in justifying their responsibility in that mass killing. If today's historians recognize the truth about the origins of World War I, at least in the relative sanctuary of academe, the mood in 1919 was quite different. German guilt and atrocities were articles of faith. To question them was unthinkable if one wished to avoid being branded a traitor, or worse. British propaganda mills had devised horror stories to suit each country's population. They were to be the cannon fodder, and they had to be convinced. For 4 years, the concoctions of the London propagandists would ceaselessly fill the ears of millions of gullible people. In big headlines, the press kept pouring out enormous lies about Belgian Red Cross nurses being shot by Hun firing squads. It depicted little girls praying to the Virgin Mary to replace hands that had been savagely chopped off by barbaric Teutons. Then there were the Hun submarines constantly seeking to send American women and children to the bottom of the sea. If these lies are laughable today, they certainly swayed people into a permanent anti-German hysteria in 1919. The cynical British establishment had used the stories to justify sacrificing the lives of Englishmen and Scotsmen, and after the war the same stories justified the subjection and dismemberment of Germany. One of the biggest lies emerged as Article 231 of the Peace Treaty. The Allied governments and their associates declare, and Germany recognizes, that Germany and its allies are responsible for having caused all the losses and all damages incurred by the Allied governments, their associates, and nationals as a consequence of the war that was imposed upon them by the aggression of Germany and its allies. Thus, Germany was responsible for everything, and was forced to acknowledge that it recognized it was responsible for everything. Next came Article 232. The Allied governments and their associates demand, and Germany undertakes to comply, that reparation be given to the civilian population of each Allied power and associate who was caused damages during the period this power was in a state of belligerence with Germany by the said aggression, either on land, sea, or in the air. When the wording and implications of the treaty became publicly known in Germany, shock swept the nation. The President of the Reichstag addressed that body, "The incredible has happened. Our enemies present us with a treaty surpassing in harshness everything the most pessimistic among us could have imagined." These words were uttered by a socialist who, along with other socialists, had proclaimed Germany a republic on November 9, 1918. They were no friends of the imperial regime they had replaced, but they were stunned by the severity of the treaty. They could not understand how the self-appointed champions of democracy could burden fellow Democrats with such hatred and greed. The Kaiser had run away from Germany to the comfort of his Dutch estate, and they were left to assume his alleged guilt. Hadn't their fellow Democrats in Britain and France taken into account that they had overthrown the Kaiser just 6 months ago? The victors took no account of it whatsoever, and for good measure the treaty made the whole German people responsible for the war. This was a hard blow to the socialists, who claimed to represent the people. The treaty's doctrine of collective guilt was an unprecedented absurdity. The German people were no more responsible than the French, the English, or the Russian people for the beginning, conduct, and conclusion of the war. None of them had any say in the plots and counterplots of their respective ruling classes, none of them were ever privy to the secret talks and treaties that precipitated the war. The people were all cannon fodder for the benefit of international bankers and their catspaws, the politicians. Filled with lying propaganda, they had rushed to their deaths by the millions. The ordinary people of all sides were the ones who had suffered most. The maggots of high finance had grown fat on these mountains of corpses. The ordinary folk of Germany, as if they had not suffered enough, were to bear the brunt of Allied punishment. They had obeyed the laws, therefore they were to pay for being loyal citizens. Of the leaders of Germany in 1914, not one remained in government in 1919. The socialists who had opposed them were now ordered to pay up. Not one in a thousand Germans or French could have explained why they were fighting each other. They might have repeated slogans that had been drummed into them, but basically they had fought for their fatherlands without analyzing the reasons. If their leaders were dishonorable scoundrels, they, the people, had no cause to reproach themselves. The Treaty of Versailles struck at what was honorable in the German people. It was unjust, outrageous, humiliating, and intolerable. Scheidemann asked on June 6, 1919, the day after Germany was handed the treaty, "Who is the honest man?" "I do not say who is the German, who, loyally respectful of this contract, could accept such conditions. What hand would not wither after having accepted for itself and for the others such chains?" Scheidemann, in any case, would not sign the treaty. "I will never put my name," he declared at the Reichstag, "at the bottom of a treaty in which we would agree that the enemy can do with us whatever it will. I will not put my name to a treaty branding the German people with shame." Scheidemann, The Collapse, page 274. Scheidemann made a proposal to his ministers: "We must declare openly and loyally to the Entente, what you ask is impossible for us to perform. If you cannot understand it, you only have to come and settle in Berlin. Do not ask us to do your work for you, do not ask us to be the executioner of our own people." Ibid, page 275. The Allies rejected Scheidemann's proposal with contempt. In Berlin, the government crisis continued. No one wanted the shameful work of signing the treaty. Finally, President Ebert called on an obscure politician to form a new government. Matthias Erzberger was named vice chancellor and emerged as the real power in this improvised government. He settled on a halfway measure: "We must sign the treaty and at the same time protest that we are doing so under duress." The House was almost unanimous in replying that it would be dishonest to sign commitments we knew we could not fulfill. Erzberger maintained, "I do not see what is dishonest about it. If you are bound hand and foot and you are threatened at gunpoint to sign a commitment that you will fly to the moon within 48 hours, what man, in order to save his life, would refuse to sign? This situation is identical to the peace treaty." Benoist Mädchen, Volume 1, page 340. Erzberger also led the House to believe he could palliate the treaty's harshest terms: "The Allies' demands are purely formal. Once we appease them on these, they will make concessions." The Vice Chancellor certainly knew better after the treatment the Allies had given him at Ratonde when he had to sign the armistice. The German Reichstag was not convinced, and Erzberger spread the rumors that Allied invasion was imminent. Many delegates panicked and took flight. And in these conditions of fear and confusion, Erzberger finally obtained the votes for his motion of vague acceptance of the treaty. Naumann, the leader of the nationalists, warned Erzberger, "We need you today, but tomorrow we will throw you out." On August 6, 1921, a young student, Heinrich Tillinson, would kill Erzberger in the Black Forest. While the German delegates were getting ready to leave for Versailles, Marshal von Hindenburg, who did not intend to submit to foreign orders, sent his resignation as chief of the armed forces to the Reich president. "I prefer an honorable death to a shameful peace, whatever sorrow," he recommended to the German people, "you may feel, your personal opinions must be secondary. It is only at the price of constant work, carried on in a spirit of unity, that we will succeed in saving our poor Germany from its misery. I salute you. I will never forget you." Benoist Mädchen, Volume 1, page 364. The two Erzberger delegates arrived at Versailles. Their hotel was immediately surrounded by barbed wire. On June 28, 1919, they were led to the Hall of Mirrors at the Royal Palace of Versailles. Ashen, eyes downcast, the German delegates were given a pen and told where to sign. Fearfully they put their names to the Allied Diktat, as the treaty was to become known in Germany. Thus the fate of Germany was sealed by a band of unscrupulous and mediocre little men. It was somewhat ironic that they chose Versailles, symbol of the French greatness their revolutionary mentors has almost destroyed, to conclude their petty and miserable vengeance.